Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Donald E. Allen for the Good evening, this is Donald E. Allen for the Bard's Poetry Revolution. And tonight I'm talking with James P. Wagner and Nick Hale, the fellows who run Local Gems Press. Good evening, guys.
Hey, Don.
Hey, Don, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Hey, Local Gems Press, that name says a lot. James, why not take each of those three words in your business name and tell us what they mean to you, and what do you want them to convey to your market?
Well, that's actually a very good starting question, because the funny thing is people say, you know, sometimes people like Local Gems, like, you know, we've got like little poetry cells, like kind of all over the country and in different parts of the world. Like, we actually started one in, you know, Manchester. And so people are like, well, how is that local? And it's like, that really sounds more like it's national. It's like, but it's still local, but it's local all over the place. Because the thing that we really were about when we started and still are about is about cultivating, you know, the local communities, no matter where they are, though. So it could be here, it could be, you know, over in Uganda, but everywhere kind of has its own local community of poets. And if they don't, they really should. But so that was why the emphasis on, you know, the local part. Especially because, you know, there's a lot of, especially in the internet world today, there's a lot of focus on, you know, you put things out online and you put out an audience and your audience will be from all over the place, but it's not really concentrated in any one area. And in some ways, yeah, I mean, some ways that's great because there's a lot of tools that you can connect all over the world. But in some cases, that's also a little bit of the opposite of the way that things kind of always worked, because when you really, you start with a local base and you build up a local base, and then once you have the local base, you can kind of expand. And I've found that to be like the stronger way to build a community. And as for the gems part, well, that's just because pretty much everywhere I've been and everywhere I've seen, there's been, you know, like these little hidden, you know, just gems and jewels of writing. You know, the Long Island poetry scene, when I first started, it's, you know, it's so rich with so many, you know, people who, like, not everybody has big degrees and not, you know, as everybody is like a famously known writer or anything, but there's so many, you know, little local hidden gems, or, you know, little diamonds in the rough, so to speak, of all these wonderful little poems all over the place. And press, well, that's just, you know, had to pick between Local Gems Press and Local Gems Publisher, and I just liked the way press sounded better.
Oh, okay, very good. And when did you get started?
2010, actually, was when we kind of first started. as Nick can probably tell you, that was when he kind of got the phone call from me. Right, Nick?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, it's funny because we started it in 2010, but it was definitely not the first time we've been talking about doing something like this. So, really, I think the idea started way earlier, and I think the first time we ever talked about it seriously was 2009. So it was sort of like it was building up to that point, but 2010 was definitely when everything started to get rolling.
Mm-hmm. And what were those early days like?
It was kind of like, well, you know, at the time, like a little bit of history there. I was writing for this website called Examiner.com, and it was, you know, kind of like, you know, in like the 2008-2009 era, there were like all these little ways that you could kind of make some money from the internet suddenly. And this was one of those websites where it's like you would post articles about different topics, and they would pay you 1 cent every time somebody clicked on it through like advertising revenue and all that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I was writing for Examiner.com for, you know, the Long Island poetry scene, because it was very hyper-local, and you could kind of pick your own topic. And so I was going around to a lot of, you know, poetry events and really getting to meet a lot of people. I had experience with the poetry scene on Long Island, actually starting back in high school. But, you know, when I was going through college, I kind of was a little bit absent for a couple of years. But that kind of gave me an excuse to really dive in and go to all these different readings and all these different events and just meet people all over the place. And so it was kind of like this great period of, you know, discovery, for lack of a better word. At least it was for me, because it was just like everything was so fresh and new and exciting, and there was, you know, places to go and people to meet, and it was, you know, there was really like a magic to it, as I, you know, think about it.
Now, very much a lot of trial and error. Sorry, Don.
No, you were so you were a content guy on the internet. You know, you were doing content for websites and making a penny a quick. What made you get together with JP and say, "Hey, you know, let's go to press"?
Nick, you want to do that first, or you want me to do it?
Well, if you guys are going to argue, we'll have JP go first, and then Nick can argue with you.
Yeah, you go first, and then I'll disagree with you. There we go.
Yeah, well, sounds about normal. I should probably go first anyway, because it kind of like my section of this kind of starts first, and then Nick's section comes in like immediately after anyway. So, pretty much how it happened was by accident. I never actually started setting out with the idea that I wanted to start a publishing company. I wish I could say, like, you know, by the time I was 5 years old, I knew what I wanted to do, you know, and I had this grand plan through, you know, my adolescence and then studied for it and yada yada, but that's just not how it works at all. I was doing the pay-per-click thing at examiner.com at the time, just as like another part-time job. And I was working, you know, another part-time job, and I was actually in graduate school at the time. And my main goal was actually to go and become a full-time college professor. And, you know, I wanted to do that until I, you know, got more familiar with the part-time college professor and decided that that was just, you know, a little bit too much work and not necessarily, for me, especially with some of the, you know, inner politics that could happen sometimes on an academic campus. But so at the time, I was involved in a lot of extracurricular activities, you know, on the campus of my college. I was involved in like 5 different clubs, and you know, the spoken word poetry club happened to be one of them. And I still, from time to time, would be, you know, I'd be going to the local Long Island poetry scene events there. And, you know, there was so much talent in both of the different groups. But they were also very different, because the spoken word group was a little bit more performance oriented and, you know, like, you know, stand up oral tradition type for like the stage. And then the Long Island scene at the time was very heavy about, you know, poems on the page and like, you know, really good writing. And so I kind of tried for a few months to get some of the people from one group to go and kind of experience the people from another group. And you know, to put it bluntly, I didn't really have the poetry street cred back then that I do now, so nobody was really listening to me. And, you know, poets will be poets, and, you know, like they say, hurting, you know, like managing poets can sometimes be like hurting cats on Mars. But so I was kind of thinking, what could I do to get them all in the same room together, just so we could have a really good event and they could both, you know, appreciate each other's styles. And I was, you know, thinking, well, if I got all, you know, some poems from all these people and I put them into a collective book, then they would have to show up to an event, because they'd want to, you know, they want to get the book and they'd want to read from the book, and then they would kind of, you know, it'd be like a captive audience. They'd forcibly be exposed to each other. And, you know, I had some experience, self-publishing some of my own little crappy books of poetry from when I was in high school. And sadly, Nick still has a couple of those. He does. He does still have a couple of those, sadly.
I do.
And so does my high school, which is kind of sad. But anyway, so I had some experience when it came to actually putting together a book, like in a digital document, and then getting it printed. So I ended up, you know, putting out a call for submissions for the first anthology. And I had like about 12 built-in submissions just from the poetry club at my college, Dowling. And then, you know, because I was going around and writing all these articles about these different poetry organizations and different groups on Long Island, you know, a lot of the you know, kind of the of the, I felt like they owed me a favor in a way. So they sent me some of their poems, and then I got on a newsletter, you know, which actually is still curated today by Barbara Rayer Myers, and she put out the call, and, you know, people were responding to it without knowing, like, who I was or how old I was, because I was, like, 23 at the time. And, you know, so people, like, were telling me, you know, like, oh, I thought you were, like, 30 years older than you actually are, like, when they actually met me. But so through all this little conniving and, you know, arm twisting, I managed to put together a little book. I do say little by today's standards, because it was 39 poets. And, you know, which is these days for, you know, some of the titles, you know, the titles we do, that's like nothing for an anthology. But for then it was, oh, my God, 39 poets. And, you know, so we put it together in a book called The Examination Anthology. And that was the first book. And I had gotten, my girlfriend at the time had a photo that was the cover. And I still have this book. The outside looks pretty good, and the content inside, you know, in terms of the quality of the poems is good, but the formatting is an absolute three-ring circus, because I didn't, you know, didn't have the experience that I did now back then with that. But anyway, you know, to make a long story short, we, you know, put together, then put out the call that we were going to have a launch event at Dowling College, in, you know, the big ballroom area, and, you know, through the Spoken Word Club, we got the room kind of set aside for us, and people came, you know, from off the campus to come and enjoy the book launch, and they all, you know, really had a good time, and they got to see each other's poems, and then they were like, oh, this is great, when are you doing, you know, what's the next anthology that you're doing? And I'm like, well, the next one? you mean
there's going to be another one?
So I kind of inadvertently set a precedent, and around that time was, you know, when Nick got the phone call from me, as he'll probably tell you.
Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. We want to jump over to Nick now, and you can rebuttal if you... What was this experience like for you, Nick? Let's hear from your end.
Let me clear up a few details here. So, no, I've known James for a very, very, very long time, and as long as I've known him, he's always had two things that he's talked about the most, and that's business and writing. And, you know, when we were in high school, he was going to be, you know, the next Ray Bradbury or Isaac Asimov. He wanted to be this great science fiction writer. And so most of the time, like, we both wrote poetry, but I didn't write fiction. He was always pushing me to write more and write more and write more. And that really has nothing to do with the story, other than to say that we talked a lot about writing and publishing, and it goes way, way, way back. So in about 2010, he was telling me about this anthology he was putting together, and also, you know, about theexaminer.com, and I got my poem in under the wire for that anthology. I think I was the last one to send in, because he kept emailing me, I need something from you if you want to be in this book. I need you to send me something. So, and that's a tradition that I hold up to this day. I'm always the last one in. So after the book came out, about a couple weeks after, and he called me and he said, yeah, this, I liked doing this, and we should do this again. And I have all these different ideas for books that we can, you know, that we can put together. And we talked about doing an anthology of fantasy-themed poetry. So this would be the first one I ever worked on, and we were trying to come up with a name, and that's when I remembered a poem that I'd read in college and really liked by William Blake. I was a huge fan of William Blake, and hear the voice of the ancient bard. And so I said, well, I'm going to call it Voice of the Bards. You know, we talk about bards and minstrels and how they used to go around telling stories in poetry form. Let's call it Voice of the Bards. And that's what we ended up going with for the title. And it's probably one of our least remembered anthologies, but it was one of my favorites to work on because the theme was really, really cool.
But it's got a great name.
Thanks. I like the name a lot. And like Examination, it was really nice looking, but we were still finding our footing in terms of formatting and all of that. And it was also probably the hardest one to put together, at least for me. But getting it out there for the first time when it finally went live was so exciting. And I was hooked. Like, yeah, we have to do more of these. When's the next one? Which is a pretty common question throughout this whole story you're going to hear is, when's the next one? And about that time, James was also working with another friend of ours, Mark, on Perspectives. And James can probably take over for that part of the story, because that's where things started to get really interesting.
Okay, so Perspectives comes up. And what happens with Perspectives, James?
Yeah, that was kind of when everything really started taking off in a direction that it was like, oh, wow, there's actually, like, you know, something sustainable long-term here. So I had mentioned that I was working for Examiner.com, you know, writing about the Long Island poetry scene. Well, Mark Rosen was, you know, he was a fellow student over at Dowling College. He was an undergrad at the time. And he was writing for Examiner.com, you know, about topics related to autism. And so he was also a poet who, as he will tell you, and has told people on similar interviews like this and other things, that I literally, well, as he would describe it, you know, I stuffed him in the back of a trunk and forced him to go to a poetry reading on Long Island just so he could do it. That's how he would word it. What really happened was I just kind of kept, you know, encouraging him to that we should go to a poetry reading together until he couldn't really keep saying no to me without, you know, pissing me off. And so we ended up going, and then he kind of fell in love with the poetry scene, because he'd always written poetry, but he never really performed it. And, you know, so he kind of begrudgingly thanks me for that still, for kind of twisting his arm long enough to get him to go. And he had, you know, he'd been going to the spoken word poetry club. So he was writing about that, and, you know, we always talked about the topic of autism. You know, Mark and I are both on the spectrum. We both had a history with various topics with autism, and so we kind of just figured, you know, well, you've got an audience when it comes to the autism topics, and I've got an audience when it comes to poetry. Why don't we, you know, this kind of just seems like a natural thing to ally. And, at, you know, at the time, there was also, you know, in the like, because social media now is like, you know, it's gone completely, it's crazy, it's exploded, but this was, you know, 10 years ago, or well, almost 10 years ago when this was going on, so it was like, you know, you didn't really, you know, there wasn't as much activity on social media back then, and so there were a lot of, you know, disability communities, they didn't really have the same kind of autonomy that they do now when it comes to talking about their issues, and so, you know, we figured that, you know, writing poetry as a form of expression would be, you know, a really great thing. And so we ended up putting out a call for submissions for Perspectives, poetry concerning autism and other disabilities. And, you know, you had some, you know, you had your, you know, quote unquote professional poets who sent poems in about the topic. I say quote unquote professional poets because, you know, in terms of like, how, like, in terms of the thing, like you get to be a poet, like true, but how many people are poets full time? Very small numbers. So,
mm-hmm. How many can feed themselves on their poetry?
If you develop a diet for paper, then you could probably feed yourself pretty good. But other than, you know.
I think it was Faulkner defined success in writing is if you write something, they write you a check, and you can pay a bill with it, you're a success as a writer. I've been fortunate enough to do that, but it hasn't been through the poetry. It's been through the fiction. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, luckily I've had, you know, with local gems, like, you know, we always tell people with the when they publish poetry books, it's like, it'll make you some money. You know, it should, you know, maybe it'll pay for a vacation or two, but, you know, don't plan your retirement around it, you know. But, but yeah,
and then
you know, what did Kerouac say about, you know, everybody knew who he was, but he couldn't afford 10 cents for a cup of coffee. So that's a whole other philosophical topic about poetry and writing, but. So,
okay, we're talking about Perspectives. Now, how does Perspectives go on and come to fruition and then lead to Local Gems Press?
Yeah, so like I was saying, they do the, you know, you have the professional poets who sent in, and, you know, their poetry was pretty good, but a lot of the poems that we got from people who were, you know, actually on the autism spectrum or family and friends of people who were on the spectrum was absolutely phenomenal. Because this was a topic very near and dear to their hearts. So, you know, we put together this book, and, you know, again, we launched it at Dowling because, you know, we have the space. But through the, you know, both the poetry audience and then the autism community audience, it started just going into places we never really expected. It started getting invites for interviews and various places, various disability groups. We started getting tables offered to us at all these, you know, autism fundraisers and stuff. And, you know, the book ended up just going all over the place. And then people, you know, so people were kind of like, you know, oh my God, I really need to get the book. We need to have you, you know, on our show and interview us. In fact, you know, that's how we started working with Natural Autistic Anka, which, you know, is a international autism foundation that's based in Canada. And, you know, worked with them for several years. And then they, you know, some of the books went up there, you know. And so it was just flying off the proverbial shelf when we didn't even actually have shelves because we were, you know, because we were doing,
the
you know, print on
the virtual shelf.
Yeah, exactly. So it just started going all over the place. And then, you know, people wanted more of that. And, you know, at that point, between Voice of the Bards with Nick and then Perspectives with Mark, and then the Examination Anthology, the precedent had just been fully set, because now it's like it was not one book, which could be an anomaly. It wasn't two books, which was, you know, just a congruency. Yeah, now it's three, so you officially have the pattern. And so
very
now
good.
People were just downright expecting us to keep on doing anthology.
And in those early days, too, we had so many ideas for anthologies that we actually – we had a little group of people together who we were all kind of brainstorming ideas. And we even started our own little private forum so we could discuss the ideas. This might be getting too much into further questions, but it's amazing how many different directions we could have gone in. It's probably very good that we didn't in terms of anthology ideas and things like that.
And so how did we come up with Local Gems Press, you know, to and what that it was after Perspectives that you decided, hey, let's get a company made and call it Local Gems Press?
Well, actually, the name Local Gems Press came when we did the Examination Anthology. And that was really just, you know, to be perfectly honest, I came up with that idea about 3 o'clock in the morning for that name, the night before I had to send the files to be printed, and I kind of figured, well, we need to actually have a name for this. It's one of those things too. It's kind of like, you know, be careful what you do early on because it'll stick with you, and then when you build the brand, it'll follow you the rest of your life if you're not careful.
Okay, so you. You were able to find enough talent locally. That's what I want to ask. So you've been able to find enough talent locally to sustain a business.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because in the beginning it was really just, you know, what we were just focused on, the Long Island, New York poetry community, and that was really, you know, the community that really came. And there was so much, you know, there was so much just. Like, it was a golden age of poetry, honestly, and it still is, because there's, you know, there's so many events and there's so many groups all over the place that were constantly doing things, but there weren't so many publishers. There weren't so many people, you know, putting it into print. I mean, there were, but there weren't, because there were a lot of people, and this, yeah, I don't know if I'm going into a future question here with some of the stuff, too, but this kind of gets into a little bit how the business evolved a little, because at the time, you know, in this period, we were, like Nick said, we were pretty much entirely focused on anthologies. And, you know, we had tons of ideas for anthologies, and we loved anthologies because it's, you know, so many different poets into one book. And, you know, the community it built and the events that we had, and it was wonderful. But then we started getting questions about, well, I have this book of poems I'm working on that's just my poems. And will you publish that? And that was where, like, you know, we were kind of hesitant at first because it's like, well, you know what? I mean, there's, you know, these other presses on Long Island, you know, there were at the time. There's, you know, there's Old Book Books. There's Boone's Dock Press. There's the North Sea Poetry Scene Press. There were all these things that were really putting out a lot of, you know, books by individual authors at the time. But within about a year, it seemed like a lot of those places either had greatly reduced the number of titles they were putting out or just completely disappeared or a combination. And so now, like, the door was really being beaten down where it's like, you know, will you publish this book? And then I made the, you know, the mistake of putting out a book of my own under the Local Gems Press brand. And people see that book with the logo on it and they're like, well, come on. So we finally, you know, caved in, and the first one that we actually ever did was Netherworld Befalls by Charles Peter Watson. And
mm-hmm.
once we did that one, you know, he schedules all these different events at various places like the Witch's Brew locally and, you know, all these libraries and stuff. And so people see it, and then, you know, three dozen more come over, and then they're like, well, I have a book too. So at that point, it was like the market had kind of told us where we were going next because we,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I like to say, and I think Nick will agree with me at least to an extent here. He might be, you know, he might try to hide it a little bit more than I will. But I say that almost every bright idea I ever had myself in my life completely blew up in my face. But everything good, you know, everything that went somewhere kind of just happened because that's where the aura or the universe or the market or the community was telling me where to go. And it's like kind of listen to, you know, what the need is in the area, it kind of comes at itself. And so if anybody out there is listening and they're at business, you know, that's just a little business thing, is there's a, you know, there's markets out there that they have needs, and if you could fill that need, then suddenly, miraculously, you have a business.
All righty. So, Nick, you have anything to add or expand on? With
oh,
what
I
James
can't
just
disagree
said?
With that, actually. Surprisingly, James and I are in full agreement here. Yeah, pretty much, because it almost worked the same way with some of the anthologies we were coming up with, where, like, some of the ones we thought, this is going to be great, this is going to be, were less remembered, but some of the ones that we put out that, you know, we were like, oh, we'll do it, nobody's going to care, but those were the big ones. Like, those were the ones that people still love and still talk about today. So I agree that a lot of sort of the best moves that we've made were made sort of by accident. I think that's true of a lot of groups.
So you have a talent base. It isn't easy to select gems from all the stones you must run across. What do you guys look for?
Nick, you want to take that one first? Since I've been...
Yeah, I'm going to take that one first, actually, because I like to say a lot of the times that there is actually a lot of good poetry out there. It's actually sort of hard to find bad poetry. It's the great poetry that's really hard to find. And a big part of it for me is, one, do I find it interesting or do I like it? And two, if I don't like it, do I see some kind of, like, skill involved in the writing, something that impresses me even if I may be bored with the poem? Because we've actually had a few poems where it's like, this is a good poem. It's publishable, but I don't like it. I'm reading it, and I'm just, either I'm not interested or it's not the kind of thing that appeals to me, but it's still worth putting in the book because it's still good. Good is something you can argue about a lot. What does it mean? Does it mean making a lot of references? Does it mean using crafting language or style? And I think it's a little bit of everything. So without using so many words to say very little, I think it's a combination of different things that we're looking for. But the number one thing is creativity and genuineness. Because we've gotten a lot of poems that seem to try to stick to a formula that, because there's a poet around here down in Virginia who likes to say that a lot of people will write poems that are publishable, but they're terrible poems. But they follow that specific formula that they think publishers are looking for in order to get published. And you see a lot of that. I saw a lot of that in college and in grad school. When dealing particularly in MFA programs, you see a lot of people who are writing in order to sound like what everybody else who's been published sounds like, just so they can get published.
Yeah,
and there's no
formula
soul to
poetry.
That. So,
yeah.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I called it formula poetry.
That's a great way of putting it, formula poetry.
I dance above the razor blades of injustice, you know, yeah, all that kind of good stuff, yeah.
I followed the recipe. Why does it not taste good?
Yes.
You know, and so I look more for the soul, but I can recognize when somebody's following the formula well because they want to, not because they think it's going to get them published. And
I like that. So I want you to say that again. You look for the soul.
Yeah, you look for the soul in the poetry. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of goes back to what James was talking about earlier with perspectives. because we had the reason so many of those poems were good was because they were genuine, because you could see the emotion in them. And like I run a workshop down here once a month, and one of the things that I look for in poems, I really like it when we get new people who come in, because they bring their poetry and it's raw and it's, you know, it's genuine, it's got soul to it. And it may not be the most elegantly crafted all the time, but most of the time, with a little bit of polishing, it can be 1,000 times better than those publishable but soulless poems that some people like to, you know, try to put out. And so that's kind of what I look for, is it genuine first?
James, you have something to kick in here? What do you look for, James?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that, like, what Nick was talking about, in the sense that there's, you know, because there's so many different types of poetry, and one of the things that I really wanted to avoid when I started this was, you know, only publishing poetry that I particularly like. Yeah, I know that sounds kind of weird, but you know how, like, when you have food, it's like you could tell food that is properly made and you could tell food that is well prepared, even if it's not a type of food that you necessarily would eat yourself. It's like I have my own likes and dislikes when it comes to poetic style and poetic formula, but I didn't really want to make, you know, like Local Gems Press be like just a reflection of, you know, my philosophy of poetry, because the whole idea of that community building is there's a lot of different ideas and there's no one idea that's correct. And so, you know, especially because I had, you know, like talking about academia, and some people sometimes think that I'm constantly just taking a dump on academia, which I'm not intending to, but there is, you know, there's some professors, you know, I mean, there's some really great professors who encourage creativity, and there's, you know, they really get your muse going, and I had some of those. But there's also the opposite, the type who have a very particular formula of this is poetry and only this is poetry, and if then it's not. And I wanted to completely avoid that, like 100%, because I'd taken a class while in college that was taught by a professor who shall remain nameless, who people would take the class, they would swear off writing poetry. They'd swear off it for the rest of their life because it was such a bad experience. And to me, that's like, that's exactly the opposite of what you're supposed to be doing, you know, as a professor, you're supposed to be encouraging it. So, so what I look, you know, I look for various things. I look for, you know, a quality in the writing. I like Nick said, I look for, you know, a sense of genuineness. I look for, you know, like something that's, you know, there's something inspiring to be said about it. But, you know, even, you know, and in that I take poetry into some anthologies when I'm, you know, one of the editors, because I don't work on, in the beginning I worked on every book that we did, but now that would be absolutely impossible because sadly I developed this habit that I like to sleep about once or twice a week. So, and, you know, once you get into that, it's just, it's all over for you. But yeah, so I don't work on every book anymore, but when I am an editor, you know, I look at poems not just through, like, my own eye lenses, but through the lenses of, you know, through a wider lens, I would like to think, or at least that's what I do anyway,
okay.
Which includes take home on subjects, you know, that, you know, I'm not even a fan of that subject, I'm not a fan of this style, but I can tell it's well-crafted, you know, so I try to kind of remove my own biases as much as I can, if that makes sense.
Okay, so I have a good understanding of what you're looking for, but here's my next question is, what can an author expect from your company in the way of value-added services?
Well, that's a good question, and I guess that would depend on exactly what it is that they're going to be looking for from us, because there's a lot of different ways that an author or a poet could kind of come in, so to speak, through Local Gems, and one of the ways that almost everybody comes in at first is through an anthology. Especially because we kind of have, you know, a policy that we don't really take, you know, we don't really look at unsolicited manuscripts from people that we don't know. So, I mean, unless it's through a contest or something like that, where we have like the strict judging panel. So most of the
You want to get a taste of them before you. You want to get a taste of the author before you take a bite.
Exactly. Especially because, you know, publishing is actually there's a relationship there and a partnership that is sometimes often overlooked. You know, a lot of people think that, oh, you're hiring a publisher, you're hiring an agent, or you're hiring this, but really, no, it's a partnership because, you know, one's providing, you know, the creative content, and the other one is physically manifesting the swirls of creativity into something that the rest of the world could actually enjoy. You know.
Okay, so you handle things like formatting, a little light editing, getting it up on Amazon, getting an ISBN number on it, all those things.
Yep, all those ancillary things that come with publishing. And, you know, depending, and one thing that we're able to say now, which, you know, is really nice, because in the early days, you know, we would have people submitting to our anthologies from all over, but, you know, if they were going to do a book or they wanted to do something, it's like, well, our events were only taking place on Long Island, New York. Now, we're fortunate enough to say that we can book events, schedule events, or have events going in quite a few different places. And so if, you know, an author happens to be within an hour or two drive of one of those places, they could come to one of the live events. And, you know, the options of where that is a lot wider than, you know, than it used to be, for sure. But in terms of what they would get out of working with us, it depends. Again, like, are they looking to just publish poems in anthologies and be part of communities, or are they looking for, you know, something like, say, starting up an anthology in their own area? Because one of the things that comes back to the local gems, as you talk about, despite it being national, is one of the things that we still, and I know that Nick and I both really love, it's probably the thing that at least I, and probably Nick, if it's not the most, it's definitely one of the things he likes the most, that we like focusing on, is actually starting local poetry anthologies in different areas. And we like that because we've seen the positive results it's had on the communities, you know, in our areas. And, you know, Nick, you know, at some point during this, I'm sure, is going to, you know, talk about how he formulated the community that he's, you know, now running in Northern Virginia, but which is kind of a good story about that. But so what I've noticed going from poetry group to poetry group in a lot of different places is there's poets everywhere. There's open mic readings everywhere, and they're all relatively the same formula. You know, you have like a featured poet, or you just have an open mic, and, you know, they get up and they do those things. But when it comes to, you know, the publishing, there's a large, large variance of how people do it. Some of the places have nothing. Some of the places have an online blog. Some of the places have somebody who will publish, you know, like their friends, you know, the people who they like, you know, and they'll publish their books, but that's it.
Then and you have a lot of vanity press out there, too. Vanity press as well, don't you?
Oh, yeah. You've got a lot of people doing like iUniverse, or just, you know, getting something from a thing and being like, well, I'm the published person on the block now, you know, and it's always funny when you see that. But so you've got like, you know, publishers in a lot of places. But the thing that surprises me is how few places I've seen actually have local anthologies that really focus on catering to, you know, the poets of that specific community, and, you know, getting like a local base that will come together once or twice a year into the same area to network and to read together, and, you know, kind of like what we do at Long Island on Bard's Day, and, you know, which has become kind of like a poet's holiday around here on Long Island. And, you know, the place that we originally thought, like, well, this is a nice big space that we could accommodate people. Now it's like, you know, we're over the fire capacity every time, but don't tell anyone, you know, in terms of that. You know,
Yeah, there's two things. I would be totally remiss as a host and an interviewer if I didn't, during this hour and a half, say, all those folks out there in the internet who are listening to this, how should they get in touch with you guys?
Well,
what's the address?
The website is www.localgemspoetrypress.com, and actually, since they're probably seeing this from, you know, a post or an email or something, it's in the description of this episode. See, we thought ahead. And actually, if people go there's a link where they can actually download 90 free poetry prompts just by putting in their email address. And our email address is quite simply localgemspoetrypress@gmail.com. So pretty
gmail.com.
Gmail.com.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned you're in a lot of different places. Tell me about the history of your growth and how you grew your company and where it's grown to.
Okay, well, at that point, I think I would like to give Nick a bit of time here to talk about what he's done down in Northern Virginia. So I think that's, you know, kind of like
we'll start from the middle.
The what?
Okay. We'll start from the middle.
Well, unless you want me to cover something before you get there, because I'm just thinking that's a great – that the story of the Northern Virginia group is a great Okay, good.
That's a good starting point. So I moved. Quick history about me. I grew up on Long Island with, you know, so the same, pretty much the same area as James. And I moved first to Texas and then eventually to Northern Virginia after college. And I moved up here in about 2012. And at the time, I was looking to get together, start a poetry community. And I went to this poetry reading by this group called the Poetry Society of Virginia, knowing absolutely nothing, knowing absolutely no one. And I found out that this reading is held every other year. So on Long Island, there are poetry readings happening every night, pretty much. There's always something to do when it comes to poetry. And the only poetry reading in this area that I found is held every other year. So that was kind of a big shock to me, because I'm sort of used to live events. And even like the groups that I found down in Texas, where I was living in the Dallas area, they meet several times a month. So that was not acceptable to me. I needed something. And at the time, I was also missing the workshop format that I had both in college and in the Dallas community. So I got on meetup.com, which is an excellent resource if you're looking to start a group. And not sponsored, but they are useful. And I started my own group. And I scheduled a workshop for a local bakery. We were going to meet at a local bakery and read our poetry and talk about it and talk about hosting readings and trying to get a monthly reading series going and all that. And so I got there. I was like 3 minutes late, and I saw three people standing out front of the bakery. The bakery was closed.
So, oh, no.
they said, "Oh, you're the poetry guy. You know, we're closed for renovations." So we went across the street to this other bakery that luckily was not closed, but was very loud. And the four of us had our poetry meeting, and we, you know, there was a lot of enthusiasm. It was really exciting. And I haven't seen any of those three people in a long time. But I found out that the Poetry Society of Virginia also does a sort of private invite-only monthly meeting, or not invite-only, but it's held in a private home, so it's difficult to know about unless you're on their mailing list. I went to one of those and met somebody else who holds a smaller local reading in the area, and they started coming to my workshops regularly. And as they did, new people who started coming in would start coming back. And so we started with four people in a closed bakery, and we ended up with our meetup group has something like 800 members right now. We regularly get
900,
about 12 to
30.
930. Okay.
930.
I haven't looked at the
who's counting.
I haven't looked at the members totals in a while, but our workshop is always very active, and I've been coordinating with other local reading groups in the area. I still have not established a regular monthly reading series, but we do certain yearly events. We hold a Bards Against Hunger every year in November. We hold a poetry masquerade, which we started 2 years ago. That's a lot of fun. It's a sort of a costume party and poetry reading. And every December we do our workshop as sort of a little holiday party. So we do a potluck and we have an extended amount of time. But what started with a small group of four people has just been steadily growing every year. And so when I started the meetup group, I also started an anthology, sort of like up on Long Island where we do Bard's Annual. So this is a collection of poetry by Northern Virginia poets. And there are other collections that do cover Virginia, but like James said, none of them do it quite the way that emphasizes the community, like we do with Bard's Annual and Nova Bards, which is the collection that I started, where, you know, we have a live event that sort of supplements the book so that everybody can get together in the same room and read from it and enjoy the poetry together and see the book for the first time. You know, we have other events sort of surrounding it, so you can actually meet the people in the book and write with them and read with them and get to know how they write. Because one thing about poetry, in my view at least, is that to become a better poet, you need to, you know, sort of consume poetry and expand your style. And it's hard to do that when you're in an echo chamber where all you're hearing and reading is your own stuff. Or even if you're reading somebody else's poetry, actually getting to meet them and talk about it is a lot, has a much bigger impact on.
Okay, so the way to grow is to network, to put yourself out there, to meet others, and then they'll meet a few more, and all these small little universes will come together into a galaxy of poetry if you put yourself out there enough.
Exactly. That's a great way of putting it, actually. Yeah, that's...
Yeah,
right. Thank
that's
you. Thank you. I think I'll become a writer.
You should put out a few books or something. Yeah.
I might, yeah.
Yeah.
Now
you,
Nick
you should,
and James...
That's a great title for a book.
Now, Nick and James, there is more to you two gentlemen than Local Gems Press. As we've heard, there is also the Bards Initiative, Nova Bards, Bards Against Hunger. The list seems endless. I think William Shakespeare would be proud of the work you were doing under the banner of the Great Bard. So please tell everyone in the audience about the work of the Bards organizations and how are they going?
Okay, yeah, because that, I mean, some people do actually say, like, what's the difference between Local Gems and, you know, the Bards? And so that's actually a good thing to kind of differentiate, because not everybody gets it, and sometimes I don't get it either. But although I do want to actually say, before I get into that, which is kind of relevant, though, a little bit about my own personal experience going down to, you know, Nick's group in Northern Virginia, because I travel down there a couple times a year to take part in some of those events. And I remember the first Nova Bards that I went to down there, you know, it was in this little community room in a restaurant, and, you know, it was a great event, but it was about maybe 20 people at, you know, probably around that at most. And like this last year went down there, the Nova Bards event had grown so much in terms of how many people were in that room that, you know, when I was posting the pictures on Facebook, first of all, actually, you yourself, Don, actually were like, wow, that group is getting big. But some people were actually thinking, is that an event that's in New York? And, you know, because it was about the same size of, like, you know, an average book launch that we would be doing here on Long Island. And so that group has really grown by leaps and bounds, without a doubt, and it's absolutely wonderful. But, yeah, so the Bards. Well, the Bards Initiative is a local, non-profit that's, in New York on Long Island that pretty much just caters to the Long Island poetry community, whereas Local Gems Press is, you know, the publishing, it's kind of the publishing wing, but it publishes things obviously above and, you know, beyond the Long Island poetry community. So the Bards Initiative, it focuses on certain, you know, annual events here on Long Island. Well, we do have a monthly reading series right now over at the Elwood Library and Less Construction, because they're redoing it, knocks us over to the Comac Library. So it kind of like a roaming bard reading. And we've had several monthly events over the years. We had one at the Roast in Patchogue. We had one at Page One in Glen Cove. We had one at Wizards in East Northport, you know, so those kind of vary. But we also have, you know, in recent years, we took over Super Poem Sunday, which is, you know, the poetry slam that we have on Long Island on Super Bowl Sunday. You know, for the poets who are not necessarily into sports, so we get together and we have Super Poem Sunday. But it's early enough in the day that if you like both, you can attend both. You know, little commercial. We also do Bards Against Hunger. We do the Haunted Barn 13 Days of Halloween reading. And we actually in recent years started doing a kind of a bi-state reading of both poems from Bards Annual and also poems from Nova Bards, where we actually get together, a bunch of poets get together at a little theater up here, and they, you know, all the poets who are in Bards Annual will read their poem from Bards Annual, then they'll pick a poem to read from a copy of Nova Bards so that they can kind of become familiar with their sister group down in Northern Virginia, which is a really great reading. A lot of people seem to love that. And then, of course, we have Bards Day, which is, at least to my knowledge, and I think I would know that if it wasn't, the biggest poetry event of the year on Long Island, which, you know, with now has over 150 poets regularly submitting to that book every year, and the event itself kind of shows that, and that it's basically an all-day event where people are reading their poems from the book, and we have these little funny skits. So Bards, the Bards Initiative is strictly Long Island. Then there was another branch that kind of, you know, broke off from the Bards Initiative, which was, as Nick talked about a little bit, the Bards Against Hunger, which has almost become like a McDonald's of poetry in the sense that it's kind of starting to become franchised all over the place. Because when Nick had his group down there, we did the Bars Against Hunger up in New York for, you know, once every year. We did it for 3 years. It was like once a year event. And the general premise was that, you know, hey, it's Thanksgiving season. Let's have a poetry reading. All the poets will bring some, you know, food that we'll donate to a shelter in our area. Because since it is about Long Island and it is about, you know, our local community, we wanted to, you know, the poets to kind of do, you know, throw in their two cents and do their part for the local community. And then Nick started doing it down in Virginia also. And that kind of got us thinking, you know, we're doing two events now for Bards Against Hunger, and that's twice the amount of food going to hungry people, and it's hitting different hungry people because it's in different areas. You know, it's different local areas. So I started thinking, would there be other poetry groups out there that might be interested in taking part in that? And, you know, and here's a pro tip for people who are, you know, poetry organizers is read the bio sections of your anthology, because one of the great things that I, you know, that I've been able to do as publisher with all these anthologies is I comb through the bio sections of all these books that we've done where we had people submitting from all over the place. And I started taking note of, you know, when people say they're so-and-so or from, you know, Connecticut or from New Jersey or from Pennsylvania or from all these different areas. And I'd read their bios and I would be able to identify, okay, who are the people who are actually making poetic things happen in their areas? And from those bios, if they had, you know, if they had a website or they had an email address I could find, or if they were on Facebook, I would start reaching out and contacting these people and kind of starting a correspondence with them and, you know, wanting to find out what they do with poetry, telling them about what we do. And then as we became more familiar, you know, talk to them about Bards Against Hunger. And because the only requirement for Bards Against Hunger is because you could do a special event, or it could just be you have your own monthly reading series. You just pick one where you get people to gather food and donate it to your local shelter. And every poetry group that we encountered or talked about it pretty much loved the idea, and then they started doing it too. And so we started forming all these relationships with Connecticut, Wisconsin, Indiana, Florida, Pennsylvania, Kansas, Texas, California, Washington. And it's just, you know, like I've lost count at this point of how many different things. Like those are just the ones that come to mind. And so it's, you know, that kind of just really exploded. So that was like, I guess, the next step of exponential growth there. And yeah, that's what went on with that.
That is great. That's one of the things I really admire about the Bards. And although I am a member and I think I know part of the answer to this, next question is, how does somebody listening to this broadcast become a member of the Bards?
Well, if they're going to become a member of the Bards Initiative, the Bards Initiative membership is for just Long Island poets. And there's the website for that, which is, you know, bardsinitiative.weebly.com. But then there's another membership in Nick's area if you're part of Northern Virginia. But to cater to the problem that one probably sees there of, well, what if you're not in either of these areas and you want to become a member? We're actually working, you know, last year we kind of did it, we experimented with it, and we're kind of working on membership options so that one could become a kind of like a national or international member of Bards Against Hunger.
Okay.
And so we're kind of working on that still about, like, you know, what you get for your membership, because in the local areas it's like, oh, you get attendance to this event and you get a copy of this book and stuff like that. But like doing it on the national level, it's like, well, you know, there's no like solid one event that you could, like, you know, get attendance to. So we're kind of figuring out that out and tweaking that, but there'll be more about that soon for the people in the different areas who kind of want to become an official member of this. But I would also say that if there's a Bards Against Hunger in, you know, your individual area, and we do have the website for Bards Against Hunger, which is just bardsagainsthunger.com, if one goes there and looks up, you know, the list of the events that have happened, and they've been, you know, in a whole bunch of different places, if there's one that happens to be in your area, I'd say contact them and see about getting, you know, becoming a member of whatever local poetry group has done the Bards Against Hunger in that area. Because a lot of them, you know, we've worked with the National Beat Poetry Festival in Connecticut. We worked with, you know, Madison Writers Group in Indiana. We worked in the Wisconsin Fellowship of Writers, who hosted Bards Against Hunger, the Clearwater Poets down in Florida, Nova Bards, you know, in Virginia. So there's all these different, yeah, I really want poetry groups from now on out there, and I'm just saying this officially, I want you all to design a coat of arms so that we can list them all on a page. kind of like, you know, what they did in the medieval times, where it's like you had, like, you know, your little, so you could represent on a banner all the coat of arms of all the different things that you do that. But maybe we should actually tell people to do that.
Well, as much as I respect you guys for what you're doing with Bards Against Hunger, which has grown exponentially, I mean, you guys, I mean, you can always tell when it's a good idea, because people will start getting on the bandwagon and join you, and the great work that you've done through that organization. But they'll tell you the truth, there's something that really impresses me. I know it's being done on Long Island, and that is your work with children. What are you doing with the kids, the young kids in school, and poetry?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. But before I get to that, though, I just want to know if Nick had anything to say about Bards Against Hunger, because the kid thing, I know I'm going to eat up the time talking about that.
Well, you said most of what I was going to say about Bards Against Hunger and the growth and how exciting it is. What I really appreciate, though, you know, is how we were able to sort of, you know, all these groups are joining, and so Bards Against Hunger is national, but at the same time, it's still local, because there's this big emphasis on the food going to local shelters, or shelters, when we're talking about, you know, local pantries. Will feed, right, groups that will feed local hungry people. For example, we're both in, James and I are both in areas, both on Long Island and Northern Virginia, where we have big cities right nearby, and it's very common for a lot of the pantries to sort of go out to the hungry people of the cities. But in both cases, you have, you know, you have hunger on Long Island, you have hunger in Northern Virginia. And even though, you know, when most people think of both areas, they're thinking of wealthy suburbs, that's not all there is to both of those areas. And so we wanted to specifically find somewhere that was going to help the needy of our own communities. Because there are lots of poetry groups in both D.C. and New York City, and if either one wanted to have a Bards Against Hunger of their own, you know, then now you guys, if you're listening, you know where to find us. But you know, the emphasis on local community is still there, despite it being a national thing, and I think that's awesome.
Okay, so we have BardsAgainstHunger.com. Is that correct?
Yep.
That's it, bardsagainsthunger.com. And if you could repeat for me the web address for the Bards Initiative.
That's www.bardsinitiative.weebly.com.
Weebly, okay. Weebly, that's the word I missed the first time, weebly.com.
Yeah, because it's a subdomain of your website. So, and actually, Nick, you have a website for Nova Bards too, right?
Yes, and that's novabards.com.
NovaBards.com.
Yep.
Alrighty.
So the kids. Yep.
Now we'll get on to the kids, the children.
On to the kiddies. Yeah. Now that was another thing that kind of happened by accident. Like I said, there's a history of good things just happening by chance. You know, because the good thing about networking and working with a community, especially in one concentrated area, and it's something that, like, because we talk so much about how we get, you know, instantaneously contact with people all over the world, and that's true, and there's so many opportunities from there that you can't, you know, that people, like, you know, kings and pharaohs didn't have the opportunities that we just have now in our pocket, you know, which is something we probably overlook. But that being said, people sometimes underestimate the pure power of, you know, locally networking and really becoming, you know, familiar with all the people who do the moving parts in your given area, because that's a whole other mess of opportunities that come from that sometimes get overlooked, you know, kind of like the Ben Franklin idea of really knowing everybody in your town and networking that way. And so through doing the Bards Annual Anthology, you know, and one of the things I'll say in general is just the Long Island poetry community in the last, you know, 10 years or so has just really grown exponentially. Like, I do actually remember a time, you know, back when I was in high school, when, you know, saying thank you both for showing up was actually a thing sometimes. And you don't really get that. Like these days, it's like, oh, man, only 20 people? What a lousy turnout, you know? Like, so it's kind of crazy how it's true. But that happens a lot through Bards Annual. And, you know, because a lot of people, you know, sometimes that book is where they come in for the first time, so it really grows it. But through Bard's Annual, I met this one individual who's the current Bard's Laureate, actually, for Long Island, and her name is Linda Trott Dickman. And she was a poet, and she's actually published a couple of books with Local Gems, and she's done the NaNoWriMo contest. And she actually just retired, but she was the librarian over at Norwood Avenue School in Northport, which is actually, you know, my town. And, you know, she's the librarian, and it's an elementary school. So she's like one of the two people in the school who sees all the students throughout the day, you know, which is, you know, a power position that people overlook there also. And she had been doing for several years this little unofficial group of, you know, poets with the kids, a little after school group, that she started kind of, you know, making it more official. And they had, like, you know, this official after school, you know, every Tuesday. And it's third to fifth graders. And she basically invited me to come and talk to them one day, just, you know, as the publisher and, you know, whatever in this area. And I did, and I couldn't stop going back because the kids were so enthusiastic about poetry. They were so expressive. They loved poetry. And I'm thinking, like, when I was that age, I didn't stay after school for anything. You know, I just wanted to go home and play Pokemon, you know, like, and these kids, they're staying after school and they're writing poetry that makes the poetry I wrote back then look, you know, kind of like blah, that's a poem, I wrote it. But, you know, so I started going back, and, you know, we started, you know, doing, you know, these weekly workshops with these kids, and they called themselves the Padawan Poets, which from Star Wars that there, no, Padawan is a young Jedi. We had to change it, though, when it came to print, to the Apprentice Poets, because I don't want to get into no lawsuits with Disney.
There you go. Yeah, Disney might win.
I think so. You know, from the company that owns everything you know and love. But yeah, so we kind of, you know, they were writing so much stuff that we had the idea, well, let's put together, you know, a book for, you know, a little chapbook of the poems that these kids were writing. And then we'll have like a, you know, a poetry recital at their school, and then their parents and their family can come. You know, same general model of, you know, Bard's Annual, but for the kids. And, you know, we did that, and especially because, like, you know, I wrote poetry when I was in school. It was usually vastly underappreciated. You know, musicians would get a recital. You know, the sports teams would get, you know, cheerleaders and pasta parties and stuff. But let's have an event here for the poets. And, you know, we did, and the parents, you know, just completely ate it up. They loved it. They loved seeing their kids in print. The kids were ecstatic, you know, just jumping around.
Yeah,
and
great.
It's like, you know, and but that's like, you know, the thing that I was really getting from that was, it was like, this is something that's really going to leave an impression on these kids for life, because now they have a positive association with poetry, which, because poetry, you know, sometimes, especially in the 20th century, it was really intimidating for a lot of people, and that included the teachers. So the teachers, in a lot of cases, they would go through the four pages in the textbook about dealing with poetry. You know, you'd read this sonnet, you'd learn iambic pentameter, blah, blah, and then they'd move on. And, you know, at the best case scenario, in a lot of cases, you would just be confused by poetry. In the worst case scenario, it was like, well, this is a boring, pedantic thing that I have to go through. And that's not what poetry is. That's just how it's been portrayed through the 20th century. And so these kids have an entirely different experience with it that, you know, is going to take them, you know, to all sorts of creative entities throughout their life. But so that was the first year. And then the second year, you know, because, you know, Linda being a librarian and part of the library systems on Long Island, we got invited to present this program, you know, kind of like a franchisable program in front of all the BOCES, you know, the Nassau County, you know, BOCES library system, to like all the 60 school librarians in the county. And they loved the idea so much. And then we started getting inquiries about doing books for, you know, these kids in these other schools, and coming and giving talks there. And then they loved that presentation so much that they've now invited us to go back to the Eastern, Western, Suffolk, and Nassau BOCES Library and Conference this November, where we're going to present it to every school librarian on Long Island. And I envision good things from that, because they, you know, there's a real passion right now for poetry. It's a golden age. And so all these librarians really love the idea of introducing it in a way that, you know, these kids really can get on board with. And, you know, I also got to tell you, we didn't really pull punches when it came to these kids. Like, we were, you know, giving them prompts. Like, they were writing triolets, you know, they were writing, you know, poems inspired off of Whitman poems. They were writing poems about, you know, pets and stuff, where we were putting them in baskets and giving them with pet food to these local pet shelters that one of the kids volunteered at. So, you know, it wasn't like, you know, roses are red, violets are blue, I love mommy too. You know, it wasn't like that. It was like real poetry, you know, so.
Very good. And a good change. You might have some explosive growth coming up, eh, with that presentation to all. And now, for those who are out of New York and really don't understand Long Island is, for the most part, wall-to-wall, shoulder-to-shoulder people. So when you're talking about all the libraries and all the school districts on Long Island, you're talking how many? Give me a rough number. 500, 600?
School librarians?
Yeah.
You know, I actually don't know, to be totally honest.
It would be tough to count. It would be tough to count.
It was 60-something for Nassau alone, and, you know, Suffolk County is, like, twice as big as Nassau County, so,
yeah.
You know, and obviously not all the librarians is one representative who comes for each school, so I would say
uh-huh.
that it's probably, I mean,
uh-huh.
it's definitely going to be over 100. I'd say it's probably going to be close to, it'd probably be close to 200 librarians, I'd say, if I had to venture a guess, but I actually don't know, because I've never been there before.
I would think all the libraries and all the librarians in schools, it's going to be, you know, you figure every town has its library and probably has three or four schools in it, you know, elementary. Do you think junior high and high school librarians will also be showing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, some of the, you know, we got approached by a couple of high schools about the program also and how to kind of adapt it for the older
mm-hmm.
age, you know, because actually, you know, and it's really great, though, because a few years back, Ed Stever, who was the Suffolk County Poet Laureate and also a Bards Laureate, he actually put out, you know, me and him worked together, we put out a little book called Unleashing Satellites, which was a compilation of undergraduate poets, you know, in college, who
uh-huh.
were, you know, so about six or seven different schools in Suffolk County, and he did that for his Suffolk County Poet Laureate project. And we also launched that at Dowling because, you know, that's where it all started, so we had to. And, it was absolutely great, but that was college age where, you know, it's a little bit more, you know, where that stuff is a little bit more liberally encouraged and a little bit more, it's a little bit more active on college campuses. But, like, in high school, you know, so a bunch of high schools do have, like, an art and lit magazine, and so sometimes you could submit poetry there. But, you know, you start getting younger than that, and it's like there's not really as much, you know, in terms of poetry as people would think. And so that entire, you know, K through 12 area is an area where there's just like, you know, there's bulging opportunity there to, you know,
mm-hmm.
convert these people into lifelong poets.
Well, you're prepared for 200, and my original estimate was 500 to 600, and I just went to Mr. Google. And I said, how many schools are there on Long Island? And it says Long Island's Nassau and Suffolk counties are home to 125 school districts containing a total of 656 public schools. And you have to assume that most of those have librarians. So you better triple your estimate on the crowd you're expecting to speak to.
Is that also open to private school librarians? Because Long Island has a lot of private schools, too.
Oh, yeah, we could go for private schools, too. So be prepared for a bigger number, James. 656 public schools on Long Island, 125 districts. So that'll give the folks out in Ohio listening to this an idea of the kind of numbers we're dealing with here. And the great job that James is doing and the great job that Nick is doing down in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, because, you know, and to that point, actually, and this is something I know Nick will, you know, kind of come back and forth with me on. But, yeah, I mean, I guess I'll have to, you know, I'll have to triple the amount of coffee I have that day, even though luckily I won't have to make the presentation for times as long. But yeah, that's like Long Island. You know, it's a very interesting area because we have the city that kind of acts as a bottleneck to entry to Long Island. And
yeah.
You know, I do a lot of traveling and I drive a lot to different things. And so it's like, yeah, going through the city can be a real pain in the neck. But there's 8 million people, you know, 8 million plus people in New York City. And there's almost that many, like there's between 7 and 8 million also on Long Island. And but because of like the insulated way that is, it's like the Long Island poetry community, it's cultivated in a way that's concentrated in like a single area that I haven't really seen replicated too many other points throughout the country, you know, because there's, you know, like, as and Nick will say, like, as in his area in Northern Virginia, you know, he gets people from lots of different areas.
That's so true. I never thought about that. We are not geopolitical, but we are geopoetic in this area.
Yeah. It's that's one of the frustrations, actually, of pretty much anywhere else, is it's very difficult to have constant events in a place where everybody is spread out. Well, I mean, when I first moved from Long Island to Texas, and then I went back to visit in Long Island, and people were complaining, oh, it's so far away, I have to drive 15 minutes to get there. Where in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, an hour drive is pretty much like across town, because it takes you about an hour without traffic to get from Dallas to Fort Worth, and in traffic, it's 3+ hours, because the traffic over there is brutal. And even around here, the traffic is brutal over here, too. The D.C. area's traffic is awful. But, you know, I can drive an hour west and find, you know, still be in Northern Virginia and drive an hour east and just be inside the Beltway, but still in Northern Virginia, but, you know, right outside of D.C. And so you have clusters of people who are doing things, but they're still considered part of Northern Virginia, whereas on Long Island, the clusters are much closer together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I know Nick has at least a couple of people who come down regularly from Maryland to go to his workshops, and you know,
yeah.
When I do, you know, because I'm pretty active with the you know, the National Beat Poetry Festival that's based in the northern part of Connecticut, but you know, half of their audience comes down from Massachusetts, and you know, then they get people coming from upstate New York over there, and you know, some other places, you know, a couple from like, you know, Rhode Island and Maine and things like that, and it's like on Long Island, you know. We don't really get that so much, because getting to the island is more difficult. I mean, we've had the occasional people come down from Connecticut over the ferry, and we had a couple people, you know, from New Jersey come. And, you know, we've actually had them bringing poets in from different areas at least to feature at different events. We actually just had Lee Hinton from Pennsylvania, who, you know, runs Lancaster Poetry Exchange. And in about a month after the National Beat Festival, we're going to be having Chris Vinoy and Rain Roberts, who are basically coming in from California and from Washington, and we're kind of going to be a stop on their way to a national, you know, an international tour over in Europe, you know, but they're coming like via the Beat Festival in Connecticut, so they're probably going to either drive or ferry down, so it's, you know, but yeah, mostly our audience, you know, our cultivated audience is very local, and you know, that's you know, there's a pro and con to that, because like, the you know, the good thing about a different area is you get all these different voices from these different places. And, you know, you get them like, you know, you get to hear different things and different cultures in a way. But at the same time, it's a little bit harder for that to actually cultivate your audience in like a given proximity. But
yeah,
on Long Island,
yeah,
we don't really get that same, you know, we don't get that same mesh from the different cultures in the same way. Like we don't get like, you know, Connecticut and, you know, Maryland, blah, blah. But in a way, it's a little it's an advantage also, because, you know, since most of the poetry events are probably within a 30-mile radius, you know, like, you know, got the border of Nassau and Suffolk, and then you've got all these events in Suffolk and all these events in Nassau, and you do have, like, some that are farther out by the Hamptons and some that are farther out by Queens, closer to the city, but most of the stuff happens within this radius, and so there's a lot of cultivation of a lot of space.
And speaking of cultivation, there's not a lot of farm poetry that shows up on Long Island. All our farms have become apartment buildings, so there might be there's corn growing in my backyard, and I don't know why. Well, that's because it used to be a cornfield. So that's that geo-poetry again. We are geo-poetic. We have the Long Island generating Long Island poetry, and we don't get a big infusion of different ideas and different perspectives. And, you know, that's something we need to work on. When I run a writing workshop, I like to make people stretch the envelope of what they're writing. So maybe, no, I'll have to pick that up. I'll have to start writing some farm poetry and see what see how far I can run with that at the next Bards meeting or Bards event where there's an open mic and I can get to read.
Well, I think farm poetry would do great in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where, you know, lots of farms out there. But, you know, but that is actually a point, though, that, like, it's important to really discuss, too, because the diversity of thought in poetry is something that, you know, in the 20th century, you didn't really get nearly as much as you should have. And, you know, there was, you know, sort of an academic elitist idea. Nick and I talk about this a lot, so I'm sure he'll have a lot to say about it. But, you know, the idea that poetry is a specific thing. And, you know, for a while, a lot of people considered it just the realm of the academics and, you know, and the professors. And, you know, I want to see the poetry by the farmer. I want to see the poetry by the auto mechanic, the landscaper, the retail worker. I want to see, the, you know, the poetry by the lawyer. You know, I want to see the poetry by the people you wouldn't think would write, you know, necessarily write poetry, because poetry doesn't just belong to any one intellectual demographic. You know, it belongs to everybody, and they'll all have something different to say and a different perspective. And that's something that we do need a lot more of.
Okay, so we've spent a good deal of time talking about the roots of Local Gems Press and the Bard's Initiative, and we've talked about the present, what's going on, and we've looked at some of the great opportunities that may be knocking on the door of you two gentlemen. Why don't we spend these last few minutes here talking about the future? What do you guys see in the future for the Bard's Initiative and for the Local Gems Press?
Okay, I'll serve the ball to Nick first.
And Nick says,
yeah,
thank you very much.
Yeah, stop hogging the ball here, James. No, that's such a difficult question, because there are so many directions we can go in. But one of the things that I personally would like to see, and I think James would agree with me on this, is more coming together of local communities into something bigger, sort of a, it's like a Voltron of poetry communities, cheesy as that sounds. But, you know, because one of the things we've been doing already with our Virginia and Long Island communities is coordinating on projects. And like James mentioned, the reading that they hold in, you guys hold up in New York every year, of readings from Nova Bards and Bard's Annual, and sort of the intermingling and bringing people together and letting people from different communities, you know, sort of read the work of people from other groups. And that, you know, it gives you, as a member of that community, a wider range of exposure, because you're going to be in front of more eyes, more people are going to be reading your poetry or hearing it, but it also allows for more diversity of style. So that's, I think, the big thing for me is just continuing to grow, continuing to connect with communities, and then connect those communities with other communities.
Okay,
yeah,
so
I mean, I would definitely agree with that, because that's, you know, and that is the direction that it seems to be going. Because right now, you know, I do sort of wonder sometimes about the collective unconscious, because it seemed like there was a great poetry awakening across the country that all seemed to happen almost around the same time, about, you know, 8 to 10 years ago, when it's really kind of started picking up. But, you know, it's like suddenly now they're starting to kind of find each other, like the different communities. And Bards Against Hunger, in addition to what that does, it's been a great tool for connecting us with communities in other areas and kind of formulating relationships. And this year, actually, and this is something I haven't really talked about a lot on Long Island, so for the Long Island people, you know, going to know this, we have Bards Against Hunger chapbooks coming out from local areas in Indiana, Wisconsin, Kansas, Texas, and Pennsylvania. And these are all chapbooks of poets specifically from those local areas and those local communities. Communities that, you know, all these other places, like, they were completely oblivious to for a long time. And I'm super excited about that. I've been working on them behind the scenes and formatting, and I have several of them now already. And they should all be out by, like, the main Bards Against Hunger season, which is usually mid-October through November. And I just love seeing them and all the stuff, because it's, like, you know, it's the validation that, like, you know, you're part of something much bigger, because you got all these people in all these different areas doing the same general thing. And you're seeing all these communities really coming together. And so it's like they're doing these books, and, you know, they're all going to have events for these books, and they're going to kind of come together in their community and network, you know, in that same way that we do, like, with Bard's Annual out here, and have these launch events for it. And, you know, it's going to help their communities, but also, you know, it's going to help other communities become familiar with their communities, because then these chapbooks are going to be, you know, we're going to do our best to kind of get, you know, kind of crossbreed the chapbooks and get, like, the people from Wisconsin to read the Indiana one, the Indiana people to read the Texas one, you know, vice versa, so that, like, people will really get a taste of, like, you know, the poetic musings and mindset of the stuff going on in the other areas. And I, you know, that makes me really happy to think about that. But One thing that, you know, is like a little personal goal of my own that I really want to do more of, it goes a little bit to something we touched on a little bit earlier on in the thing, is I want to start hosting workshops and seminars dedicated a little bit more to the business side of poetry when it comes to how to host a proper book launch, how to partner with local bookstores or local gift shops to get books in those places, how to write towards a specific theme or how to figure out the theme of what you're writing, and then you compare that with an organization or something that you could act, because, you know, there's, you know, like the prevailing mindset that there's no money in writing, there's no, you know, power in poetry and blah, blah. And I mean, it's a cliche for a reason because it's been that way for a long time, but it also hasn't really been. Because if you really think about it and you look at it, there's poetry everywhere. And it's in everything from, you know, your local bar to high-end businesses. I mean, Hallmark, you know, cards is basically poetry. You know, Dr. Seuss is poetry.
Uh-huh.
You know, you get corporate meetings when they get together with, like, these multimillionaires in a room, and they'll listen to, like, an inspirational poem before they have their meeting so that they could get into the mindset of how to be productive. And so it's everywhere. It's just that when you call it poetry, you know, you start off saying, well, I have poetry. And they're like, oh, poetry. But when you're like, no, I have this inspirational verse to help get you in the spiritual mindset to be your most productive for this meeting. Oh, great. Let's hear it. You know? So a lot of it has to do with the presentation and how you do it. And there's a lot that I think a lot of poets and poetry communities, especially when it comes to organizing, because, you know, you look at the other artistic communities out there. It's like the music community, the art community. You know, you have your local grassroots, and then you have your academic, and then you have the industry. And, you know, I know industry is this big word we're all supposed to be afraid of, but the industry is the thing that stays constant during the fluctuations of everything else. And in poetry, you've really just got the grassroots, and then you've got the academic. You don't really have an industry. And we kind of need to have at least some kind of second cousin to an industry to keep these things going so that there will always be these events and these workshops and these things cultivating, you know, the poetry creativity. Because without that, you know, they'll come and go. Like I've seen over the years, you know, as much as I've seen so many wonderful readings and wonderful events, I've also seen a lot of, you know, people come on the scene and leave the scene. I've seen events start up and then close. I've seen a lot of publishing companies start up and close really easy because people sometimes underestimate how involved it is. And, you know, so there's a business side of things that, you know, sometimes needs to be addressed. And, you know, the formula, you know, for that actually I feel like a lot more poets and poetry organizers could probably double down on and learn a lot more of. And that will help, you know, just poetry itself keep moving forward, you know, the vehicle of poetry.
Yeah, it's very important for an author to understand. But the danger is they might start writing for that purpose, but as long as they have that clear in their mind that no, you're not supposed to write, you know, to a formula, but this is understanding the business mechanics of what's involved. Yeah, I think that would really help a lot, you know, for authors to get an introductory class or a workshop on those subjects. So when you come out with them, I'll be sure to sign up. I know that much. I could use a little expanding of my knowledge of that area.
Yeah, well, I mean, in you know, in your case, you know, you have several poetry books about, you know, the Civil War and the history. And so it's like that's a topic right off the bat that would be very easily matchable with several things. And, you know, you look at, like Nick and I sometimes we discuss some of the, you know, the topics of some of the books that we've done. And, you know, we've had breast cancer books that, you know, match with breast cancer, you know, fundraising and communities. We've had people who do books about, you know, pet rescue that matches with that, the autism topic, you know. And, you know, but even things down to just the general idea of how to host a proper book launch, which, you know, is something that a lot of people don't really necessarily do in the way that at least Nick and I think that they should. Because sometimes people will, they'll come out with a poetry book and then they'll, quote unquote, launch it at a regular monthly reading. And to me, that's kind of like, you know, oh, I'm going to have my wedding at, you know, this Friday's local, you know, pub gathering. It's like, you know.
Well, you know, a lot of authors are very private people. And you know what? They're a little afraid. They're a little bit afraid of that public appearance that's so much a part of a book launch. You know, I think that's got a little bit of play in there. There are people who are a bit shrinking violet from that type of exposure.
Mm. Yeah, no, some of them definitely, but then you got the opposite of the people who love the spotlight and definitely want to be up there. So, but you know, like a book launch, it's a special event, so it should be, you know, its own thing. It should be like a day that is, you know, it's like a wedding, or it's like, you know, a shower, or it's like something special. Because how many people, you know, I know, you know, people sometimes underestimate how rare publishing a poetry book is to everybody else in their life who's not a poet. Because another thing the poets mm-hmm. do sometimes is they only sell their poetry to other poets. And, yeah. you know, to other poets, poetry is not rare to poets. You know, like we all, you know, we know a lot of people mm-hmm. who have books and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But to everybody else in your life, you know, like how many of them, like they've probably been to some kind of book signing or some book launch for some famous author, but how many of them actually know somebody in their family or in their friend group that have come out with a book? You know, that's rare to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier Manchester, England. I'm assuming that's Manchester, England that you mentioned earlier today, correct?
Yes, we do. That's actually another offset that's going on there, but I just wanted to give Nick a chance to talk about it. He has an author who just published a book in Virginia who actually went out to California and now has, you know, how many bookstores does he have his book in?
Oh, yeah, I'll explain that, but just before I do, to interject, we have about 4 minutes left of the broadcast. But, yeah, this author, Keith Munro is his name. He just came out with this book, Leave Youth Behind in Sorrow, and he went out to California to visit his brother, and I think he signed consignment deals with three or four bookstores in California while he was there, and his brother was going to help him to get into bookstores in some other places, Japan, and I think he mentioned Kenya and the UK also. So he, by going over there and going to the readings and just by reading his poetry, he was able to impress the bookstore people enough to get them to sign. And that's the value of sharing your poetry and having the readings and putting yourself out there. So even though it may be scary, and he tends to be a nervous reader. I've seen him like physically shake while he's up there and reading. All he had to do was put it out there, and you know, they loved it.
Yeah.
I
got a copy up here of that book for myself, and I absolutely love it. But yeah, so the Manchester, England thing, that actually, you know, that's another kind of branch off of the Bards that's actually happening over there. Because there was a contact, you know, we made a contact out there with some people. They're actually calling it the Buzzin' Bards.
The Buzzin' Bards.
The Buzzin' Bards, because, you know, apparently the, you know, bees in Manchester is like has a big cultural significance. But, you know, the person, Benjamin, who is actually in charge of the group there, they, you know, because we actually, we gave them use of our meetup account. We started up a meetup, because with meetup.com you could pick your location. So basically, you know, through our meetup, we gave, you know, we set it up with the Manchester location, had him sign up and made him a co-host to just, you know, get word out to the local area, because the great thing about meetup is it really like targets people locally. And he submitted, you know, poetry to various things. He was in the Bards Against Hunger 5-year book, and he actually is about to come out with his own book of poetry through this last year's National Poetry Month contest. And so the group right now over there through the meetup, it has 62 members. They had it's kind of like the same formula with Nick's, with you know, what Nick did in Nova Bars, because they had just had their first workshop. Only 5 people showed up, but they were all incredibly enthusiastic. And, you know, they're looking to put together a little small publication, the Buzzin' Bards, over there. And he's already planning on doing a Manchester Bards Against Hunger reading. And this guy is actually a chef by trade, so he wants to actually cook a whole bunch of food for the event, or he's talked about that. And he also works at a university, so he's, you know, like, it's going to shape up really nice over there. And it seems like they're really enthusiastic, because there's, you know, as he said, like, some of the things that happen in areas with open mics is there's open mics, but then sometimes the music takes over the open mic, and so having specifically for having specific poetry things is really important. So, mm-hmm. so yeah, that's something that we can look forward to happening.
Okay, well, gentlemen, we have about a minute and a half. Anything you guys want to talk about for a whole minute and a half that I haven't covered for you?
Nick?
Don't all run for the microphone.
I have stuff I could talk about. The problem is a minute and a half is definitely not long enough to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, if we're a minute and a half, Yeah, if it's a minute, if we're a couple of minutes over, it'll just go into recording, but, you know, it just won't be live anymore. But go, so people will be able to listen to the full thing.
Right, right, that's right.
Yeah,
it's been a while since I've done one of these. No, I think this was great. I think it was I enjoyed sort of digging into the history, because from the beginning, from maybe like the after first Bard's Day, I'd say, we've had people coming up and asking us, you know, how did you guys get started? How did this whole thing start? And what's the difference between Local Gems and the Bard's Initiative? Probably the two most popular questions, at least that I've been asked. James, you've probably gotten a lot more questions than I have, because you're obviously on Long Island all the time. So it was great to finally get out there and sort of put it all out. And so, James?
Yeah. No, it, you know, I think you covered pretty much everything that we could have expected to with this history. I mean, it's an interesting history. And, you know, people don't really believe me when I say that this whole thing happened just by happenstance and by accident, because they're so used to, you know, I think that's a lot of, like, you know, success stories have a tendency to, I think, over embellish just how, you know, much they really had a handle on things, when, you know, it's like, nah, you know, like, because we stumbled into a good formula that worked, but we stumbled into it. You know, it was completely by accident. Like the anthology formula in the beginning, because that's something that, you know, a lot of publishers, when they start publishing individual books, the community doesn't grow as fast, because there's not as many people directly involved. You know, because when you got 50 poets in one book, it's like that book itself is almost a mini community. And so, you know, and also from the business perspective, that, you know, that's also, they're getting a sampling of the product first by being a small part of a bigger thing. And then, you know, that leads into then their own book. So it's, you know, it was something, you know, we just stumbled on it, and we didn't, you know, at first we had no idea of this, you know, the precious formula that we had kind of stumbled on, but now we kind of have at least a, you know, somewhat better understanding of it, and it, you know, it's really great. But, you know, I also want to, you know, thank you for, you know, doing this interview with us, because, you know, without you here asking us the questions, then it would just be Nick and I talking.
Yeah, thank you. We have enough of that.
Well, you're both very welcome.
We'll return the favor sometime, because, you know, at some point in these future episodes, we'll have to get you on, and we'll have to, you know, talk to you about your, you know, your Civil War poetry books and your other poetry projects and all the stuff that you do, because you've got quite an impressive resume, you know, on your end of things too.
Thank you very much. And, I really appreciate the Bard's Initiative and, all the work that you do with, Local Gems Press, because you've been instrumental in my career, and I thank you all very, very much for that.
Well, thank you for being a part of it, you know, and then, you know, thank you for doing what you're doing, because I know that you host workshop groups now, you know, and you do all sorts of things yourself to really help cultivate the vehicle of poetry. So, you know, and that's exactly what, you know, what poetry needs, is we need more of that out there. So it's great.
All righty. Well, gentlemen, I think at this point I will say good night and good writing.
Okay, and I think we'll play off with a little song. So, bye, everybody.
Bye.